This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is engineering. It's Monday, June 19th, and this is Gay Pride Week. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. On this program, we regularly challenge and expose the malfeasance of governments and expose the ideology of our leaders as a class bias distortion of reality. We attempt to bring into focus the possibility of another reality, one grounded in the principles of equity and justice for all peoples. In sober recognition of Gay Pride Week, Fran Michelle, our well-read Red, is here with a report on the situation of gays and lesbians in Iraq. It is not a celebratory story, but an important one for all those interested in gay and lesbian rights. Also on the Old Mole today, Bill Resnick will be interviewing Christopher Phelps, former Portland activist, now teaching history at Ohio State. Bill will also be on later with a short interview with Jill Epsonshod of San Diego State, who has written a book called Monitoring Sweatshops, Consumers, and the Global Apparel Industry. In between will be Fran's report on gays and lesbians in Iraq. I will be discussing Thomas Frank's 2004 tome entitled What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Now here's Bill Resnick talking with Christopher Phelps, educator and activist.
Christopher Phelps, welcome to KABU.
Oh, thanks, Bill.
Christopher Phelps teaches at the Ohio State University. He's a historian. His book, The Young Sidney Hook, is, how would you describe it, Christopher?
A perennial bestseller on the New York Times list.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
It's a study of the early years of a New York intellectual, anti-Stalinist, Marxist, and philosopher.
Right. And to some extent, you go into his becoming an anti-communist, I guess.
Yes, his sort of proto-neoconservative.
But a very sophisticated, in fact, socialism. In his early years, yes. Christopher Phelps also wrote an introduction to Upton Sinclair's novel, the famous novel, one of the great American novels, still read around the world, The Jungle. And his essay is, that essay is really interesting because it puts the jungle into historical and social perspective. Christopher, you, why were you chosen actually to write that? The introduction to this edition, it's really for students and for especially college and high school kids to understand the novel better.
Yeah. Well, it's part of something called the Bedford Series in History and Culture, which is a series of affordable historical documents that's put out by Bedford St. Martin's, a publisher. And it's quite well known among American historians. Their list is assigned often in introductory U.S. history courses, and I've used many of their titles over the years because the students love them. They tend to have accessible introductions, and then they have important documents from American history. And so I actually approached them. I knew that the centennial of the novel was coming up, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, first published in 1906. So about 2 years ago, I approached them, and I noticed that they didn't carry the title in their series, and yet it's in the public domain, the novel, now being 100 years old, and so it's free for them to print. And I thought it would be perfect for their series. So I worked this up. It's got this long introduction by me, as you say, and it's also got some other things that are useful for students, a bibliography about Sinclair and his life, a chronology of Sinclair's life, a set of notes that go with the text so that things in the novel that are not necessarily transparent to readers today are explained.
What I really liked about, I really enjoyed reading the introduction. I have to admit, I didn't read the novel again. 40 years ago was enough of meatpacking, the glories of the meatpacking industry. And anyway, I like to eat sausage now and then, and I don't want to have my enjoyment ruined.
It's a novel that, without the author intending it, has produced its fair share of vegetarians.
Yes. But really, the novel, that was one of his goals. Another sort of goal in the novel, and I think was really interesting, and you brought it out, was the way in which Sinclair was sort of promoting his vision of, trying to promote his vision of socialism, and within it, he spent a good deal of time, quite consciously, it seems, to discuss, or at least to portray, to illustrate the way Jurgis Rucus, the novel's protagonist, came to sort of a radical consciousness. And I thought that's what we could discuss today, and that process, both Sinclair's vision of the process, which it seems to me is particularly early 19th century from an elite perspective, but then also then the very changing sort of notions of the way people come to consciousness through the 30s and 40s and 50s, and now today yet another kind of notion. Tell us though about Sinclair's vision of the way Ruckus discovers this, this radical commitment.
Maybe before. Before I do that, it would be good for me to give a little bit of a synopsis of the novel.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Because some listeners may have actually read it, but not on the face of it remember it, because
right.
It's very commonly assigned in high schools still. But this is a novel about a Lithuanian immigrant, fresh off the boat, who ends up in Chicago just 3 days after entering the country with his family in tow, and is quickly...
And high hopes for the future.
Very high hopes for the future, a commitment to work harder, sort of a Horatio Alger sort of work ethic, and yet runs into all sorts of problems in industrial Chicago of the turn of the century. He enters the meatpacking industry, and he's young, he's virtuous, he's physically a titan, and yet he degenerates in the meatpacking plants of turn of the century Chicago. And it's an often used work to recall the experience of industrial America and the experience of immigration in history classes. I think it's probably read more often in history classes than it is in literature classes. And so it's often taken as a document of social realism, as sort of a transcript or a description of what it would be like to be in a factory at the height of industrial America, and how exploitative and degraded labor was, how difficult it was to work in such a factory. And then, of course, there are all sorts of gruesome details, as you alluded to earlier, about the nature of meatpacking. Now, actually, a good part of the novel is outside of the meatpacking plants, but because that occupies the first half of the novel, it's what most vividly comes back to mind when people consider the jungle. But what you're getting at is something sort of a more profound reading of the novel, which is to try to assess what Sinclair's point of view was, because this is not simply a work of social description. It's not simply a reportage. It's also a reflection of the author's point of view, and in particular his politics. His politics at the time that he wrote it, he was very young, Upton Sinclair, 26 years old when it came out. And he was a new convert to the Socialist Party, of Eugene V. Debs, and it was on the ascendance at this point. In the early 20th century, it was really its heyday, and it peaked around 1912, right on the eve of the First World War. And he's writing a novel not simply to depict the maltreatment of immigrants, the degradation of the urban poor, the poor quality of inner city life, the difficulties of factory labor and all that, but he's also trying to explore working class consciousness and to stimulate in the reader not just a desire for social reform, not just a desire for government regulation of the industry and more humane treatment of immigrants, but also a socialist consciousness, a political consciousness that would lead them to political involvement.
Right. Well, in that he sort of failed, though. He even recognized himself, right, when he said, "I was aiming for the heart and the mind," I suppose one could say, "but I hit the stomach."
Right.
What happened was there was a great revulsion, but it didn't lead to changes in real working conditions at all, or for somehow elevating the worker that he was interested in. It led to pure food and drug laws, basically.
Right.
It led to the progressive period. It's
complex what happens with the novel. I mean, in some ways it fails, and in some ways it succeeds. But in that immediate political objective, it fails. And on the other hand, he sort of had a sneaking pride in having had a role as a catalyst in pushing these reforms. The very year the novel appeared, the Pure Food and Drug Act and the Meat Inspection Act were both passed. Signed into law by President Theodore Roosevelt, a Republican. This was back in the days when there was such a thing as a liberal Republican. And that the novel is given credit by virtually all historians for having propelled those pieces of legislation forward. And they did significantly strengthen the way in which meat is overseen by the government to be sure that it's produced in sanitary, properly labeled, fashion.
Right.
But the question as to whether socialism as a project did not succeed or has not yet succeeded in the United States. But on the other hand, many people over time have read the novel and drawn socialist conclusions from it, and or at least give it some significance in their own personal development. People like Howard Zinn, the historian, Kurt Vonnegut, and other readers have encountered the novel in adolescence, and it had a sort of powerful effect on them. I myself don't find the end of the novel, where there's a sort of long set of discourses on socialism, very compelling. And many literary critics have found it didactic, that is sort of preachy, and view that as the least, ironically enough, the place where it gets closest to the socialist ideology of the author is where the novel fails to engage as literature.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say it hasn't worked with some readers. It has, but in any case, what were you getting at with the
let me do a station ID, Christopher, and then we'll get back. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Christopher Phelps, who did a wonderful introduction to the Bedford edition of the Upton Sinclair's 1905, 1906 novel, The Jungle. Christopher, we were... let's talk about the he introduces the idea of socialism in a didactic way at the end and talks about it and sort of develops the necessity for a differently run economy. What was his vision, though, of the way that Rudkus himself then becomes, of course, a committed socialist? But he, tell us about how he's Sinclair described the vision. We have to move on right now as well. We only have another 9 minutes, so.
Okay. Well, Jurgis, who's not gifted in brains particularly, although he has many other good moral attributes and so forth, sort of goes through a set of hard-knock experiences, and it takes him a long time to figure out that capitalism isn't quite working out in his personal life. So in some ways, the novel's quite good about political consciousness not coming automatically from adversity for the poor. He gets involved in a trade union and in a strike, and this doesn't work out very well. And this part of the novel, in some ways, quite effectively portrays the limits of unions and even the defects of unions as they existed at the time. This is a time when, you know, trade unions were often quite limited in their scope and in their vision and their methods. So actually, it's long after he'd left the meatpacking industry. Jurgis sort of bounces around the countryside. He, you know, works for farmers. He's an itinerant laborer, which is not uncommon for the lowest part of the working class of the day, you know, moving with the seasonal crops. And eventually, he does all sorts of other things. He's a steel worker for a while. He winds up back in Chicago, and he's sort of entered what Marxists would call the lumpen proletariat. He's involved in criminal activities, and then he's on the streets. He's essentially homeless, and to get warm, he wanders into a socialist meeting hall almost by accident. And who is speaking but this great orator, who of course is a stand-in for Eugene V. Debs, and it's like a lightning strikes or a light bulb goes off in Jurgis's head, and he, you know, listening to this long speech about the exploitation of the working class and the possibility of a newer, higher social order, he gets religion, and it really is a conversion sort of narrative in which he acquires faith in an instant. And then he's taken into the socialist movement, and he actually meets a socialist owner of a hotel who gives him his first decent job in the world, being a bellboy, essentially. And so life is good after that. And he has these conversations with high-tone socialist ladies in a parlor, in which he's sort of instructed in the fine points of socialist doctrine, including whether or not, for instance, socialists are automatically atheists, and these sorts of questions that were big at the time. And Sinclair uses the education of Jurgis to kind of give a set of, you know, instructive points about the nature of socialist commitment and thought.
Right. It seems to me that that sort of notion that socialism comes as an epiphany from great people, and that it sort of should be brought to us by enlightened owners although I'm not sure how he thought the enlightened owners were going to affect. And to create a kind of a managed society of enlightened people, good for the workers, that notion, both of that notion of socialism, but also the notion of the way consciousness develops, it seems to me, changed just immensely in the course of the century. I mean, and a kind of really intelligent, in some ways, socialism from below sort of notion became the kind of tactical, strategic approach. Maybe you could explain. And give us a few novels of people who actually do better on at that approach.
Yeah, what you're saying is very. It's in some ways Sinclair was ahead of the curve in that it's not at all economically determinist. Excuse me. Which, you know, many people accuse socialist thought of being. That is, you know,
right.
An automatic process of of being in a factory would lead you to be a socialist.
Or being in a factory with a fighting union is a more sophisticated vision.
Or even massive strike, which is based on a real strike in Chicago in 1904 that Sinclair was interested in. But it's disastrous, and nothing automatically changes in Jurgis's thinking coming out of that, except to sort of sink further into depression. There's a disconnect, in other words, between economic life and politics in Sinclair's rendering of this, because the idea is that you've tried at the point of production. You've tried through trade union activity. You've tried through a strike. That didn't work. So what the answer is you now must vote for socialist candidates like this brilliant one who's speaking. And if you, at the polls, elect socialist politicians, they will eventually take the reins of the state. They will introduce public ownership of the means of production. And, of course, if these big factories were publicly owned, they wouldn't maltreat their workers. They wouldn't cheat the consumers. They'd be governing in the public interest. But of course, this bifurcation that there's a virtue in the novel in that economic determinism is not the basis of consciousness. The problem in the novel is that there's this disconnect between economic life and political activity. And as you're suggesting, it's only across the century that we have a sort of sense that political consciousness and the workplace can be integrated. In fact, that it's sort of the basis of any working class movement is going to have to be that kind of integration of the two, and you get more of that, or at least you get a more complexity in some later novels.
Sort of building consciousness, and or at least contributing to consciousness as struggles go on, rather than thinking that either you have to somehow preach to people outside of the workplace, or a sense that somehow it will spontaneously, when people are really in action against the bosses, they will spontaneously make commitments and then begin realizing in another world is possible. Those are sort of utopian and unrealistic. But there is you were going to talk about, let's conclude this with novels and artistic works that in fact have a better sense of the combination of, the way in fact people become committed.
Yeah. Well, for example, some of the novels of John Steinbeck in the 30s, the In Dubious Battle, which is less well known than The Grapes of Wrath, but has a sort of politically committed organizer who's involved in a strike. John Sayles' novel, he's a filmmaker, and people would know him for his films more than his novels, but he has a very interesting novel called Union Dues about a sort of working class kid out of West Virginia who becomes involved in the New Left, and there's a lot about his sort of thinking about class and politics, which of course is related to Sayles' movie Matewan, in which you also have a portrayal of a strike in West Virginia coal fields. I don't know, I'm just sort of skimming over things here, but in all of these, I think that sort of the relationship between real social struggles as experienced by people and political consciousness is fused a little bit more coherently than it was in The Jungle.
Mm-hmm. I'm still keep thinking about Christopher here. Look for novels, and we'll talk about it again, that are really sensitive to the way people develop a sense of class deservingness and where they get a sense of confidence in others and in the collective capacities to, in fact, self-manage. Those sort of notions that are at the foundation of a radical consciousness. It seems to me we haven't really done really the left. Progressive novelists have not done very well at really presenting the real complex way that people gain those kinds of commitments.
Mm-hmm.
Next time, Christopher, let's
It's a tall order.
Well, write the novel.
I've never written a novel. I won't be too hard on the novelist.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Yeah, pleasure, Bill.
Right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bill and Christopher. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. With us in the studio now is our well-read Red, Fran Michelle, with a report, at least in part, on the gay and lesbian community in Iraq.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle, here for the Well-Read Red. We're all glad to be here this morning to report that yesterday Portland did not suffer an earthquake, a tsunami, or a terrorist attack, nor did the Bonneville Dam collapse. All of these events were predicted by a Salem pastor as God's punishment for our celebration of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender pride, as reported on Alas, a blog, as well as by the Portland Mercury. Pride celebrations usually occur in June, in commemoration of the 1969 Stonewall riots, when police raided the Stonewall Bar in New York, and the patrons, many of them black and Latino drag queens, fought back. Clashes between police and the gay and lesbian community continued for several days, and the incident is considered a turning point in the modern gay movement. Marches were held the next June in New York and San Francisco, and pride parades and events now occur all over the world, including Sao Paulo, Jerusalem, Taipei, and of course Portland. Last month, the San Francisco Chronicle reported gay and lesbian activists attempted to hold Russia's first gay pride march in Moscow, timed to coincide with the 13th anniversary of the decriminalization of homosexuality in Russia. Although the march was thwarted by opposition from police and from nationalist and fundamentalist opponents, organizers considered the turnout a sign of victory, as queer Russians claimed their rights to public space. In the U.S., pride events have other problems, too. Ryan Murphy, on his blog Liberal Serving, bewails the commodification of pride, asking, "From a spontaneous riot of trans women and other sundry queers who were fed up with police harassment devolves a corporate branding opportunity? How can they crap all over us in legal discrimination after constitutional amendment, but throw products and advertising at us like we're Jane Q. American?" Charlie Hinton, writing last month in dissidentvoice.org, recalls that, in 1975, he became a founding member of an organization called Bay Area Gay Liberation. This was the time of the war against Vietnam, the civil rights movement, black power, brown power, and women's liberation. Queers became the next group to challenge the traditional values of heterosexual white male ruling class dominance. The idea behind gay liberation is that no one is free until all are free. The politics of liberation advocate building a united movement to overcome all forms of discrimination and oppression if LGBT people are someday to be truly free. In the late 1970s, a gay rights approach to gaining equality became the dominant ideology in the lesbian gay movement, replacing the gay liberation approach. The idea behind gay rights is more limited. Build a movement that addresses strictly gay issues, housing and job discrimination, military, marriage, partnership, etc., and unite solely on the basis that we're gay, Gay Pride Day being one example. Hinton argues that we should return to a liberation approach. At the very least, he writes, gay men should unite with women to protect choice and reproductive rights. The same groups are trying to take away all our rights, as well as any rights for immigrants and prisoners, and it's stupid and self-defeating not to join forces to fight them together. In the bigger global picture, it's the same anti-gay, anti-choice, anti-democratic right-wing forces that drive the conservative agenda, which includes the occupation of Iraq, Afghanistan, and unquestioning support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Do we make the world safer with more war and more and bigger weapons, he asks, or with more justice and equality that all can share? And speaking of Iraq, Gary Leop, also on Dissident Voice, observes that even leaving aside the daily collateral damage killings of Iraqi civilians and the occupiers' failure to accomplish the most basic reconstruction goals, the collapse of law and order and accompanying empowerment of fanatic religious militias has made life hell for women, Christians and other religious minorities, and intellectuals, and of course, for queers. Last month, Ali Healy, who used to run a gay nightclub in Baghdad, told the Times of London he knows of more than 40 Iraqi gay men killed this year. Quote, "We could never envision this happening when Saddam was overthrown," the 33-year-old, now in exile, declared. I had no love for the former president, but his regime never persecuted the gay community. Healy told Democracy Now, it's a very dark age for gays and lesbians and transsexuals and bisexuals in Iraq right now. And the fact that Iraq has been shifted from a secular state into a religious state is completely, completely horrific. In April 2005, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani declared that homosexuals should be killed in the worst, most severe way, and Iraqi militia have been tracking down and brutally murdering gay men and boys. Last month, following the murder of a 14-year-old boy by the Iraqi police, al-Sistani removed the anti-gay male fatwa from his website, retaining one against lesbians. Not that this will necessarily change the militiamen's behavior toward gays. Al-Sistani is viewed by the occupiers as an ally of sorts, since he has discouraged armed resistance and commands the respect of Shiite politicians. So while officially troubled by the burgeoning misogyny, religious intolerance, anti-intellectual, and homophobic plagues unleashed by the illegal overthrow of the former regime, U.S. spokespersons can't attack too squarely the Muslim fundamentalist repression exercised by their sometime allies. If someone is in danger of being slaughtered or persecuted, we do all we can to stop it, says Army Major Joseph Todd Breesdale, chief of the Media Relations Division of the Multinational Corps in Iraq. In other words, the U.S. military, which officially regards gays who are out as unsuitable for military service, does want to stop the slaughter of Iraqi gays. But, he adds, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when we're in a fledgling time like this to go in and say, here's the issues that are going to, these are the issues that are going to repel 80% of the population, and this is what we want to inflict on you. We're not trying to get into too many values judgment type issues and just do the right thing. That's what Breesdale told the Washington Blade, the Capitol's GLBT newspaper. So let me get this straight, Layup continues. In this fledgling time, while the primordial chaos of the criminal invasion still prevails, the occupiers, bogged down in suppressing resistance to their presence, slaughtering civilians in the process, haven't much wherewithal to prevent other indigenous Iraqi slaughter. The occupiers have better things to do than get into the values judgment issue of shooting 14-year-old gay boys, especially if 80% of the population has no problem with that. That'd be inflicting somebody else's values, although not apparently the major's, and that just wouldn't make sense, would it? So doing the right thing must mean doing something else. Publicly acknowledging that gay people shouldn't be murdered, probably, and it's not the occupiers' policy that they should be, but hey, this is the Iraqis' business. At least they're free now. For the Well-Read Red, this has been Fran Michelle.
People go, people try, people go, people try, let's rise to get by. Don't.
Thank you, Fran. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. You are listening to the OMO Variety Hour. In the 1992 election, which put Clinton into office, James Carville, an advisor to Clinton, explained the victory with a phrase that became a buzzword during the 90s. It's the economy, stupid. Turns out Carville got it all wrong. In Thomas Frank's 2004 book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, Frank seeks to set the record straight. As the Democratic Party moved more and more to the right economically under Clinton, economic issues gradually faded in importance as working class and rural voters of the heartland came to perceive little difference between the two parties' economic policies. It was no longer economic issues that motivated voters. It was, or at least became, the culture, stupid. We've all seen the political map of the United States following the last two presidential elections. The blue areas on the map represented the states that went for either Gore in 2000 or Kerry in 2004, and comprised two narrow strips, one on the West Coast and the other on the Northeast Coast. Virtually the entire remainder of the country was colored red, denoting those states carried by Bush and the Republicans. Although Florida and Ohio may have been exceptions, through political manipulation, they both made it into the red zone as well. Kansas, along with the rest of the Midlands during the Dust Bowl Great Depression era and on into the Roosevelt years and beyond, had been a hotbed of radical left politics. Now Kansas is among the most arch-conservative states in the Union. What's the Matter with Kansas is the story of how and why that happened. Although Frank thinks that the Republican culturally conservative juggernaut was an irresistible force, a political tsunami of the prairies, he does blame the Democrats for rolling over and getting swept away by the tide, or dust, to remain consistent with the metaphor. The Democrats' move to the right on economic issues was an attempt to win support and get into the deep pockets of those of the affluent who are moderate or conservative on economics, but progressive on social and cultural issues. Democrats believed that they could always be perceived, that they would always be perceived as the more liberal on economic issues than the Republicans, so that it could essentially abandon its traditional constituencies, since they would have nowhere else to turn. As it turns out, that had to be the most ill-conceived plan of recent American history, until Bush lied and swindled us into the invasion of Iraq. Although it could be argued that the Democrats self-destructed, leaving a vacuum that the right wing merely filled, Frank gives the argument short shrift. In his telling, the Democrats were merely dupes who played right into an already successful Republican strategy. A strategy which goes something like this. Liberals represent abortion, gun control, desegregation, affirmative action, softness on crime, gay rights, secularism, feminism, evolution, big government, and on and on. In addition, these East and West Coast liberals are atheistic, unpatriotic, elitist, effeminate, pointy-headed intellectual snobs who have nothing but disdain for the true American values of the heartland and those who espouse them. We've seen the Republican strategy at work in the last couple of weeks as the situation in Iraq continues its downward spiral and the economy is in the tank for everyone but the rich. Ignoring these vital issues, Bush was out rallying the faithful with a speech about the specter of gay marriage and the need for a constitutional amendment to forever ban it. At the same time, the Republican Congress reopened a needless and irrelevant debate on Oregon's assisted suicide law. Don't people resent being so obviously manipulated? Bush and company apparently think that his vast culturally conservative constituency is just too dumb to get it. Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas is not a revelatory book. The themes I have been describing are things we are all more or less aware of to one degree or another. However, the extent to which this mindset has enshrined itself in American politics is shocking, and the book is, though depressing, an often funny and absorbing read. Since we all know how it ends anyway, at least for the time being, I will close by reading from Frank's sobering conclusion. Behold the political alignment that Kansas is pioneering for us all. The corporate world, for reasons having a great deal to do with its corporateness, blankets the nation with a cultural style designed to offend, and Kansas is duly offended. The state watches impotently as its culture, beamed in from the coast, becomes coarser and coarser and more offensive by the year. Kansas aches for revenge. Kansas gloats when celebrities say stupid things. It cheers when movie stars go to jail. And when two female rock stars exchange a lascivious kiss on national TV, Kansas goes haywire. Kansas screams for the heads of the liberal elite. Kansas comes running to the polling place. And Kansas cuts those rich rock stars' salaries. Taxes, excuse me. As a social system, the backlash works. The two adversaries, meaning the wealthy elites and the working and rural poor, these two adversaries feed off each other in a kind of inverted symbiosis. One mocks the other, and the other heaps even more and more power on the one. This arrangement should be the envy of every ruling class in the world. Not only can it be pushed much, much further, but it is fairly certain that it will be so pushed. All the incentives point that way, as do the never-examined cultural requirements of modern capitalism. Why shouldn't our culture just get worse and worse if making it worse will only cause the people who worsen it to grow wealthier and wealthier? Should you ever happen to take the tour of Kansas City, Kansas, that is prescribed by the 1939 WPA guide, you will notice a peculiar thing. Many of the features it highlights are no longer there. You'll find no trace of the tower built as the tallest in the city, or the elaborate Italian Renaissance architecture of the public library, or the city's many meatpacking plants, or even the panoramic view of the bend in the Missouri where Lewis and Clark landed. The spot where the visitor was supposed to stand has been leveled by the confused, culling ramps of an interstate highway. This disfigured landscape is a large part of my father's Kansas City. From a childhood spent riding the now-vanished streetcars, he knows where each once grand avenue in the old metropolis will take you, what businesses used to occupy each abandoned building, what each erased neighborhood it was called, and precisely where it stood. He remembers the big bands playing at the now-demolished Plowmore Ballroom and the proud newspaper pictures of the Wichita machinists pasting dollar bills on their thousands V-29, and the packing house workers streaming on foot across the now-disused James Street Bridge, a form of transportation as inconceivable here today as are the urban neighborhoods in which those workers once lived. As you cast your eyes back over this vanished Midwest, this landscape of lost brotherhood and forgotten pride, you can't help but wonder how much further it's all going to go. How many of those old, warm associations are we willing to dissolve? How much more of the garden of the world will we abandon to sterility and decay? My guess is quite a bit. The fever dream of martyrdom that Kansas follows today has every bit as much power as Kansas native John Brown's dream of justice and human fraternity. And even if the state must sacrifice it all, its cities and its industry, its farms and its small towns, all its thoughts and all its doings, the brilliance of the mirage will not fade. Kansas is ready to lead us singing into the apocalypse. It invites us all to join in, to lay down our lives so that others might cash out at the top, to renounce forever our middle American prosperity in pursuit of a crimson fantasy of middle American righteousness. I've been reporting on the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America by Thomas Franks. Now here's Bill Resnick back talking to Jill Espenshod about her new book, Modern Sweatshops, Consumers and the Global Apparel Industry.
Jill Espenshod, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Jill Espenshod teaches sociology at San Diego State University. She wrote a wonderful book, Monitoring Sweatshops, Workers, Consumers, and the Global Apparel Industry. Jill Espenshod, the point of your book, the essence of it is, I gather that there's really no way of ending sweatshops or protecting worker rights just by codes of conduct and occasional kinds of inspections, which is one way it was tried. And you argue that it has to be really done by empowering workers and giving them the opportunity and the right to form organizations, labor unions, employee struggles against their bosses for better conditions and wages. And also struggles, of course, with the governments of their of the countries. Tell us, how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I did an in-depth study of the monitoring industry in Los Angeles and internationally, speaking to over 140 workers, contractors, employers, and government investigators. And the study actually began...
Doing a lot of interviews with them.
Interviews, right. In-depth
right.
interviews with them.
Right.
I also observed on monitoring visits. And I really began the study because... I don't know if your viewers remember Kathy Lee Gifford crying on national TV, but in 1996 we had the Year of the Sweatshop, and the Department of Labor of the United States government became very interested in fighting sweatshops under, this was under Clinton, and they began a program of monitoring and later created a partnership with between nonprofits and corporations to kind of bring their monitoring program, which they had developed in Los Angeles, to an international forum. And so companies began monitoring their sweatshops across the world, their factories across the world. And the critiques that I developed of the program in Los Angeles, which were largely that corporations were in charge of a program that was meant to discipline them and workers were unaware of a program that was meant to benefit them, were also true on the international level. So you have corporations actually hiring monitors, deciding important things about the monitoring programs and overseeing them in some ways. And you have workers being interviewed in the workplace by investigators who are often, come from a corporate background in front of their bosses or where their bosses can know they're being interviewed, representing what the position or the perspective of the worker is on their conditions. And I felt that this was, and had a lot of evidence to show that this was not an accurate portrayal, that these investigations do not give an accurate portrayal of the conditions in these factories, which mm-hmm. include a lot of violations of local laws in terms of forced overtime, unpaid overtime, sexual harassment, women being forced to take birth control pills. In some countries, workers' documents are confiscated. They're not allowed to actually leave the workplace, or they're often migrants or immigrants from other countries. So there are a whole variety of violations that are commonplace in the industry and that continue to be commonplace even with widespread monitoring today.
Mm-hmm. What about monitoring? Some groups in the United States demand independent monitoring, that the companies, in fact, don't hire the people and do it, that they pay money into a fund that would then be run by independent people, nonprofits, who would hire the monitors, who would be there for a whole, and create the monitoring system, that in fact might get a much more accurate portrait of what's happening in those places.
And that has been more successful in some cases. It depends on a number of things, including the kind of monitors that are being hired. So a lot of monitoring companies are actually branches of corporate accounting firms or corporate entities that have grown up, just that have emerged just to do this kind of monitoring and are still working with a kind of company side mentality of proving things, you know, by looking at the books, which may not be accurate, rather than taking the word, being suspicious of the word of the workers. Other independent monitors are actually grounded in the communities where the workers live and have much more access to the workers outside of the workplace and have been able to do more thorough investigations with more accurate a look at both sides of the question that's going on the shop floor. So some of those are more successful, and the most successful ones have been the places where there's actually organizing going on the shop floor, so where monitoring is coupled with trying to protect labor rights.
Right. That's what we want to get to. Even the best monitors are going to get frightened people unless there's real protections for people and unless the the people are able, that is, the workers are able to organize and defend one another, it seems to me, on the shop floor, in their social lives, in their neighborhoods, then when the monitors come, even the best of them are going to get these stories from frightened people who know that they can be singled out and not merely fired, but in fact much worse. Give us a sense of why you think that, and how, in fact, the organizing rights of people can be supported by us in the United States.
Well, there's a number of reasons that it's important for workers to be organized in terms of having truly effective monitoring. As you said, they're not afraid to participate in it in an open and honest way. They're able to monitor their shop on a day-to-day basis rather than once in a year or once in a three-year period where you don't get an accurate picture of what's going on daily. And, of course, they're able to better their conditions in some situations. The problem is that where monitoring has been combined with a true struggle by workers to exercise their rights to bargain collectively and to associate, in many cases, those factories have actually been shut down or contracts have been cut once the company complies and does what they're supposed to in terms of recognizing the union or recognizing the workers' rights. The company then turns around and cuts the contract with the factory. And so the factory owners don't have a lot of incentive to comply with these codes of conduct in that realm. And what some groups in the United States are now asking for is not only for companies to monitor, but for them to actually buy goods from factories in which workers are organized or have some kind of representation. And this is particularly true of the student movement at the universities. So USAS, the United Students Against Sweatshops, has been spearheading a new campaign called the Designated Supplier Program, where they're asking universities to buy their logoed goods or have their licensees contract the logoed goods from factories that are not only investigated and monitored, but factories where workers actually have the right to speak up and to organize. And an increasing number of factories will be coming online through that program, and universities will be requiring licensees to purchase an increasing percentage of their goods from such factories.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Jill Espenshade, who teaches at San Diego State and wrote a really interesting book, Monitoring Sweatshops, Workers, Consumers, and the Global Apparel Industries. Jill Espenshade, we have another just a couple of minutes. I was hoping you could respond to that, to this group of sort of company apologists who argue that the anti-sweatshop movement is actually bad for people in the poor world because it reduces investments in many of the countries. And they in fact arguing that sweatshops in some countries are in fact a good thing. How do you respond to that argument? And what is the argument first? I didn't do it very well. I know you know it, their argument better.
Well,
and how do you respond?
Several arguments. One is that sweatshops provide jobs for workers. Another is that they provide a road towards development for countries, and that they provide an income in terms of hard currency going into those countries. And so you can address this on a number of levels. One is to ask, well, what, you know, these jobs may be preferable to domestic service or really hard rock agriculture that some of these women are coming from, but they aren't the only possible job creation program that could be invented. In fact, it's a job creation program that relies on low wages, hard work, long hours, and particularly on the vulnerability of the workers.
And disposable people, basically.
And disposable people. And if the government's actually enforce their laws in terms of workers' rights, not only to get the benefits that a lot of these countries actually have written into law, but also to organize, they would no longer be competitive in the global economy for these jobs. And so we've created an entire system largely under things like the World Trade Organization and monetary loan programs like the IMF and the World Bank that require these countries to lower their standards, require these countries to set themselves up to attract this kind of investment rather than some kind of alternative investment that would actually grow an independent economy in the country. A lot of people think that these factors actually make countries dependent on what I would call the wages of empire, so that you have a country like El Salvador in which these factories were proliferated by U.S. aid, went in, built the infrastructure, created these factories, and now that because of some changes in the trade regime, these factories are moving out of El Salvador to China, they need to scramble to find another way to have jobs, which are also dependent on the United States, things like call centers. They're now training bilingual people to have huge call centers in El Salvador, encouraging their populations to go abroad and send remittances back.
Rather than a real process of development.
Exactly.
Jill Espenshade, we're going to have to end now. Let's another time actually talk about the global environment and the ways in which the dependent countries are being forced into this enormously exploitive labor regime and the alternatives to it. I think that's what we really have to talk about. Sweatshops are terrible because there are real good alternatives to it. And to that form of development, which really is not development. It's just another form of exploitation. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, and I'd love to talk to you another time. Thank you very much.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes our program for today. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is our engineer. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Stay tuned now for the food show.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
The 14th Annual Good in the Neighborhood Multicultural Music and Food Festival beginning at 12 noon on Saturday and Sunday, June 24th and 25th. The event is located at King School Park at 4815 Northeast 7th Avenue next to King Elementary School. The festival kicks off with an annual community parade at 11 a.m. on Saturday from the Emmanuel Hospital parking lot and features 2 days of fun, music, food, and festival. The musical performers include Linda Hornbuckle Band, Patrick Lamb, Norma Sylvester Band, Andy Stokes, Ocean 503, and much more. For more information, log on to www.goodintheneighborhood.org or call 503-282-1288.
It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's the food show. We got a show about nutrition program for women. That's WIC. Also a short feature about the Interstate Farmers Market and an interview with Farmer John. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, hear an interview with Carol Williams, one of three journalists the U.S. has barred from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman speaks on the new class war in America. Right now, we're going to go to the food show.